Russell is also journalist and political commentator. Said Mohsen Abbas speaking to us from the British capital, London. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul in ويعلم ما في السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء. يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير محضرا وما والله رؤوف بالعباد.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time, and Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The U.S. government releases the first batch of documents that supports allegations about Saudi Arabia's role in the 9/11 terrorist attacks. An Iranian Navy flotilla returns from its mission to the Atlantic Ocean after sailing through 45,000 kilometers. Israeli warplanes conduct fresh airstrikes on the Gaza Strip, targeting several areas south of the besieged Palestinian territory. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Badr Sajafi. Good to have you with us. The United States has declassified a batch of documents that has strengthened suspicions of Saudi officials' involvement in the 9/11 attacks. The hugely redacted documents detail logistical support a Saudi consular official and a Saudi intelligence agent provided to at least two al-Qaeda operatives involved in a hijacking of airliners using the attacks. The FBI found the agent deeply involved in providing travel assistance, lodging, and financing to the hijackers. Members of the Saudi government have long been suspected of involvement in the attacks. The Saudi embassy in Washington, D.C. has, however, denied Riaz's role. The documents are being released on President Joe Biden's executive order. He issued the order after more than 1,600 families affected by the attacks demanded him not to attend ceremonies marking the 20th anniversary of the attacks unless he released the documents. A flotilla of the Iranian Navy has returned home after accomplishing its mission in the high seas. The vessel arrived in the southern Iranian port city of Bandar Abbas early on Sunday. It was welcomed by ranking military top brass. Present at the ceremony was Commander of the Iranian Army, Major General Abdurrahim Mousavi, who praised the crew members of the Iran Armada for having completed their mission successfully. He said that the Navy fleet carried out its mission in the worst climatic conditions and amid the enemy's political campaigns and psychological warfare. The general said that the historic mission was accomplished thanks to the Navy's prudence, knowledge, and bravery under the guidelines of the Islamic Revolution's leader. The commander of the Iranian Navy has given us some details regarding the mission of the Navy flotilla, which came back home after a 45,000-kilometer voyage.
During this mission, this destroyer experienced four seasons and it passed across the two hemispheres. It was important for us to, I mean, my comrades here, it was important for them to hone their skills, to when they showed their capabilities and they demonstrated their skills. And what was important was that they didn't stop during the mission without any need for any logistics. They went all the way to their destinations and came back. And this shows that in the domain of naval missions, it is important that definitely equipment run into problems, technical problems, one way or another. But their capabilities were so high that we didn't need any assistance from any ports in other countries. The U.S. does not have a proper understanding of Iran, and they do not know our capabilities. And they just read some reports Well, you see, anybody who is wise enough knows the capabilities of Iran. So anybody who is wise enough, he or she knows how things play out. So, and this mission was accomplished powerfully, and we will continue our presence with more might and power and with more lofty objectives.
An informed source has stressed that there will be no change in the International Atomic Energy Agency's access to its cameras at Iranian nuclear facilities. Now, this as the IAEA chief, Rafael Grossi, has arrived in Tehran on an official visit. The source dismissed Western media reports that Iran has agreed to grant the agency access to its cameras in the country's nuclear sites. It is stressed that the talks with Grossi will only include repair and maintenance of some of the IAEA's monitoring equipment. Iran restricted the agency's access to the cameras as part of its commitment cuts under the 2015 nuclear deal, the JCPOA. Tehran says the move is in response to the other signatories' failure to uphold their ends of the deal. Meantime, JCPOA revival talks in Vienna appear to have stalled. The political commentator Mike Harris says the double standard that Iran is being subjected to regarding its nuclear program are outright hypocrisy.
The expectation, the double standard that Iran is being held to compared to neighboring countries in the region like Israel, who has a very vigorous and active nuclear program, but yet no one acknowledges it because they keep it secret. This is outright hypocrisy here. And I think that we need to push for not just a nuclear-free Middle East, but for a nuclear-free planet, nuclear-free globe. As I stated, the double standard that Iran is held to is not reasonable. And I think the Iranian government, the Iranian people have a right to refuse this because there are certain national security interests that every country has, and a nuclear weapons program. The only reason to have a nuclear weapons program is to keep yourself from being invaded by other aggressor countries. It's not a very good weapon all in all, but it's such a devastating weapon that no one's going to want to interfere with your internal affairs if you're a nuclear power. So I think that Iran needs to stand their ground, and I think that they need to say, we'll do what the rest of the world does regarding their nuclear weapons programs. And so the U.S., Russia, France, Great Britain, Israel, they've all set a standard about what is in their national interest. And I think Iran, as a sovereign nation, has the exact same right to do the exact same thing.
Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi has just arrived in the Iranian capital, Tehran, on a one-day trip. He's going to hold talks with officials here. Kadhimi is leading a delegation of top officials. This is his first visit since President Ebrahim Raisi took office over a month ago. The two sides are expected to discuss bilateral economic and political issues. Other issues on the agenda include regional security and relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia. The foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian visited Baghdad in late August to attend a regional summit there. Now in other news, Israel has carried out fresh airstrikes on the Gaza Strip, targeting several areas south of the besieged Palestinian territory. Warplanes fired at least six missiles at Rafah in southern Gaza. The Israeli military claims that it targeted positions belonging to the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas. It says that the air raids came in response to rockets and incendiary balloons from the coastal sliver. No casualties or material damage have been reported. Welcome back. Let's take a look at the COVID situation around the world. An anti-COVID green pass protest has been in Rome. People who attended the rally call on the government to withdraw a provision that further extends COVID-19 health pass scheme.
On Saturday, in the Italian capital, hundreds of people staged a protest against the mandatory anti-COVID green pass, which came into effect on August 6 and whose effects are set to be further extended. The Italian government is planning to make the so-called vaccine passport a requirement for employees at all public sector workplaces, as well as potentially at key businesses in the private sector, including supermarkets. At the rally, protesters were holding banners which read "United for Freedom of Choice" and "Hands off our children."
We are against all discriminations. People should be free to choose what's best for them, as stated in our constitution. Let me make clear that we are not against the vaccine.
Imposing a vaccine passport is nonsense. It's tantamount to blackmailing people. Furthermore, vaccines are still experimental and there are many unknowns about their effects.
The vaccine passport has been required since early August in order to access cultural and leisure venues across Italy. From September the 1st, the health certification has become obligatory for long-distance trains, domestic air flights and schools amid widespread grumblings.
Free vax protests held across Italy over the past weeks have often turned nasty. A few days ago, the police staged raids in several Italian cities against anti-vax extremists, during which weapons such as knives and clubs were found.
Le azioni sicuramente ledono.
These episodes have certainly affected our campaign. Let me add, however, that the media have purposely emphasized isolated incidents with the sole aim to criminalize all forms of dissent. So far, after weeks of protests, 8 people only have been put in custody by the police.
Anti-COVID Green Pass protesters at Saturday's rally in Rome were joined by supporters of far-right party Forza Nuova. An anti-vaccine passport protest was also held in Milan, with about 5,000 people parading in the city centre. Max Civili, Rome.
Well, that was Italy. Now let's take a look at Turkey. Thousands of people have held a demonstration in Istanbul against COVID-19 vaccinations and the government's coronavirus-related restrictions. The protesters say the new measures violate their rights and are against international law. On Monday, the government began requiring proof of vaccination or negative COVID tests for all users of inner-city planes, buses and trains, as well as for those attending large events such as concerts. All unvaccinated school employees are required to take a PCR test twice a week. Masks and social distancing are required in public places. Some 65% of Turks have received 2 vaccine shots. Still, around 23,000 new cases on average are reported on a daily basis. Clashes have erupted between Greek police and anti-COVID vaccination protesters in the northern city of Thessaloniki. A police fired tear gas and used water cannon to disperse the crowd, authorities saying that around 1,000 protesters tried to reach the venue where Prime Minister Mitsotakis was delivering his annual economic policy speech. Protests against the country's vaccination program started in July after the government announced mandatory jabs for health workers and nursing home staff. Nearly 6,000 health workers have been suspended for missing a deadline to get at least partially vaccinated. Now let's look at India. The country has reported more than 28,000 new COVID infections in one day, and that's the country's lowest daily count over the past week. Health Ministry also confirmed 338 virus-related deaths in the same period. New figures bring India's caseload to over 33 million and the total fatalities to more than 442,000. Despite the overall decline, Indian authorities are putting restrictions on major gatherings across the nation. They warned that a new wave of COVID-19 has already started in the country's financial hub, Mumbai.
Last month, India witnessed a steep surge in coronavirus cases, mainly due to public celebrations in the southern state of Kerala. India is the second worst country in the world in terms of infections after the U.S. Catalan protesters have marched through central Barcelona to demand independence from Spain. Now, police say around 108,000 people attended a rally, but organizers put the figure close to 400,000. Some of Catalonia's pardon leaders and activists who had been jailed for their role in the 2017 independence bid were also present at the event. In Catalonia, September 11th marks La Diada, the anniversary of the fall of Barcelona to Spanish forces in 1714. Pro-independence Catalans have been marking the event over the past decade with mass demonstrations. The U.S. president has issued a vaccine mandate, which would apply to around two-thirds of all American employees. The decision has drawn criticism from senior Republicans who are threatening to sue the Democratic administration. In the meantime, the fate of the U.S. economy is hanging in the balance.
The coronavirus pandemic has not only cost countless lives, but has hit the world economy hard. The United States, which has the world's biggest economy, hasn't been an exception. The U.S. is the world's worst-hit nation by the pandemic. Under former President Donald Trump, the country launched a program called Operation Warp Speed to facilitate and accelerate the production and distribution of COVID-19 vaccines. U.S. pharmaceutical companies developed several vaccines and rolled them out to the country's population. Trump's successor, Joe Biden's administration, set a target of vaccinating 70% of the country's population, at least partially, by the 4th of July. However, the country met the target a month later, despite generous incentives given to Americans.
At least 40% of the U.S. population is a victim of a lot of silly conspiracy theories about the vaccine and are adamant about not taking the vaccine. It's a big problem in the U.S. that's been stoked by social media and QAnon and, you know, career right-wing politicians who are manipulating it all for their personal gain. So the U.S. Is confronting with this real problem.
The vaccination program proved effective at bringing down the daily COVID cases and deaths, but up to a certain point. The highly infectious Delta variant of the coronavirus sent a new wave of cases and fatalities across the world. Scrambling to contain the spiraling outbreak, President Biden announced new mandatory vaccination plans on Thursday.
I will sign an executive order that will now require all executive branch federal employees to be vaccinated. All. And I've signed another executive order that will require federal contractors to do the same. If you want to work with the federal government and do business with us, get vaccinated.
But in addition to saving lives, the U.S. government is aiming at saving the economy, too.
Well, it certainly would help because we have a problem going on of a lot of workers not wanting to go back to work now that the COVID Delta variant is accelerating in a lot of places in the country. That was obvious in the last month's job report.
The mandatory vaccination program has triggered a backlash from American conservatives.
The U.S. government's mask mandate proved to be a divisive topic among Americans, with conservatives voicing the strongest opposition. Now, the same continues with COVID-19 vaccines, as just over 50% of the country's population is fully inoculated, far below the previous projections. The other point of disagreement between the two political camps has been President Biden's most recent stimulus plan that is being criticized as harmful to the economy in the long run.
Hours after the Democratic U.S. president announced a coronavirus vaccine mandate for federal workers, Republicans lambasted the decision, suggesting that it's unconstitutional. Figures, including Republican National Committee Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel, threatened to take legal action against the Biden administration. A majority of the critics are questioning the administration's authority to declare such a mandate. Back in March,
The Democrats in the U.S. Congress passed a bill for a $1.9 trillion coronavirus stimulus package without a single vote from Republican lawmakers. The plan was intended to send direct payments of up to $1,400 per person to the majority of American households, extend a $300 per week unemployment insurance supplement, and put funds into vaccine distribution. The Republicans argued that the package was superfluous as the economy was reopening anyway. They believed the economy would suffer down the road considering how big a figure the bill earmarked. With the United States COVID-19 figures rising in recent weeks, economic indicators are expected to be negatively impacted. Biden's unprecedented and aggressive move to make vaccines mandatory for a considerable portion of the American society can highlight the gravity of the risk the U.S. economy is currently facing from the deadly contagion.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response.
Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans, and I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Ruqayya, the innocent martyr of Damascus. In the name of God, the All Merciful, the All Compassionate. Hello, dear friends, and condolences to you all on a very poignant day. The anniversary of the martyrdom of a girl of only 4 years of age. Please stay with us. Today, the 5th of Safar, is a doleful day in Islamic history. It is the anniversary of the martyrdom of a girl who was just 4 years old. Yet, despite her tender years and the sorrows she suffered, including the loss of her father, torture at the hands of his murderers, and imprisonment, she was a picture of virtue, faith, piety, prudence, forbearance, and patience in the face of acute oppression, to the extent that even the elderly women held her in high esteem. These are the days during which, in the year 61 AH, in the aftermath of history's most heartrending tragedy, the caravan of captives of Karbala was in Damascus, Syria, after being dragged in ropes and fetters through Iraq. It was made up mostly of children and ladies, of the Ahlul Bayt, or blessed household of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The lone grown-up male was Imam Zain al-Abidin, peace be upon him, who was waging a unique jihad to awaken frozen human consciences. The ladies indeed played an important role in conveying the message of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, to the people of their times, and subsequently to posterity. Their names are alive until this day. The chief among them are, of course, the Holy Prophet's granddaughters, Hazrat Zainab Kubra, peace be upon her, and Hazrat Umm Kulthum, peace be upon her, The other prominent female members of this caravan of captives were the daughters of the martyred Imam. Fatima, Sakina, and little Rogaye, peace be upon them, in addition to Fatima, the daughter of Imam Hassan Mujtaba, and wife of Imam Zainul Abidin, peace be upon them. Little Rogaye, who continuously lamented the loss of her father and was constantly scolded by the captors, finally succumbed to her sufferings in Damascus, Syria, and was laid to rest in the dungeon, which has now grown into a grand mausoleum and site of pilgrimage in the Syrian capital. These ladies were entrusted with a precious mission, and without them, the lives of the men would have been lost in vain, if the Muslim community at large did not wake up. When the public saw Imam Zainul Abidin, peace be upon him, along with the ladies and children as prisoners, learnt of their identity, and heard their sermons, they realized the truth that the tyrant Yazid had committed a most sacrilegious crime in martyring the Holy Prophet's grandson, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. If the ladies and children had not been there, Yazid's men would have narrated their own version of the events of Karbala, and the Umayyad propagandists would have twisted the accounts of the battle to absolve Yazid. These ladies and children were indeed the shield of Islam, and this was the reason Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, had brought them from Medina as living proof of his message and martyrdom at the hands of an ungodly ruler and his oppressive regime. Yet such was the self-control of Imam Zainul Abidin, peace be upon him, and his aunt Hazrat Zainab Kubra, peace be upon her, as well as other ladies and children, in spite of having suffered such ordeals, that they never allowed their grief to be a hindrance to their mission. The conscientious among the Syrians, on seeing the children and ladies of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, mistreated by being paraded through the streets of the bazaar in horrible conditions, realized that Yazid was making a deliberate personal attack on the Prophet of Islam and his progeny. As for little Rogaye, peace be upon her, although she graced the mortal world for just 4 years, she has left an indelible impression on history and the minds and hearts of believers. Born in the city of Medina, she accompanied her father to the fateful field of Karbala, witnessed the tragic martyrdom of her father, brothers, uncles, and cousins, suffered the calamities of the journey to Kufa, and then onwards to Damascus, from where her blessed soul, after bearing oppression beyond description, flew to the ethereal heavens. She used to cry silently and quickly wipe away her tears for fear of scolding and whiplashing by her tormentors, who did not show the least mercy to the great granddaughter of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. In the prison in Damascus, she would stare at the flock of birds flying to their nests at sunset and innocently asked her aunt, Hazrat Zainab Kubra, peace be upon her, will we ever be going home like those birds flying to their homes? Alas, she was not destined to. On the 10th day of Muharram, the epic day of Ashura, she had given the goatskin water carrier to her uncle, Hazrat Abul Fazl Abbas, peace be upon him, to fetch water for her and the thirsty children in the encampment. When her valiant uncle departed for the besieged river, the children gathered around little Rogaye, with their earthenware cups, eager to taste the elixir of life after 3 days of thirst. Alas, her uncle never came back. While bringing water, he was surrounded by the cowardly enemies, who riddled the goatskin water carrier with arrows and eventually martyred him after cutting off both of his arms as he bravely defended himself. On that fateful day before Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, marched out to the battlefield, little Ruqayya had requested him one last time to allow her to lie down on his chest, as was her habit of sleeping. When her father's horse, Zuljanah, returned riderless to the encampment and neighed in a sad manner, she knew Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, was martyred. Her agony, however, did not end. That the heartless enemies burst on the now undefended camp to loot and burn. She huddled around her aunts, but Shemr, the dastardly assassin of her father, snatched away her earrings that caused her great pain as blood flowed from her earlobes. Despite her tender age, she was tied with ropes along with rest of the noble members of the household and taken to Kufa, and finally to Damascus, the capital of Yazid, where she saw the horrible sights of the head of her father placed before the tyrant on a tray. In the prison of Damascus, Ruqayya, peace be upon her, who was wise beyond her tender years, saw a dream while asleep, and on waking up suddenly started crying, looking for her father everywhere. All the ladies tried to console her, but she didn't get any peace and cried, saying, "Oh, my dear aunt, where is my father? A few minutes ago I was in his arms and he kissed me and said to me that, my dear Ruqayya, you will soon be with me." On hearing about her dream, all the ladies started to cry and the wailing was so loud that it reached the palace of Yazid, who inquired the reason, and on being informed of the situation, in a sadistic manner he sent the severed head of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, to the prison. On seeing the head, the little girl started to cry even more and held it very tightly. She wailed, "O father, who cut off your head? Who killed you? Why are we being held as captives?" With these words of sorrow, little Ruqayya suddenly felt silent. Everyone thought that she had finally gone to sleep, but this was not the case. She had gone into permanent sleep. Her brother, Imam Zain al-Abidin, peace be upon him, on checking her pulse, found that her soul had flown to the ethereal heavens, and she had finally achieved martyrdom. She was laid to rest in the same place, which is now a grand mausoleum visited by pilgrims from all over the world, who beseech God on her behalf, and their prayers are answered.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
On August 30th, 2021, just as the clock was about to strike midnight, the last U.S. forces departed from Kabul International Airport, finally bringing the war in Afghanistan, America's longest war, to an end. At least officially, anyway. Right on the cusp of the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, Joe Biden declared he would not pass on the war that he voted for onto a fifth president, declaring the U.S. counterterrorism mission in Afghanistan complete. But how exactly can Biden talk about a successful mission and a successful withdrawal when the U.S. and the Afghan forces had spent years training were all but chased out of the country? And during the evacuation, a suicide attack ripped through Kabul airport, killing 170 people. And in response, the U.S., of course, finished the war the same way it started the war, by massacring civilians in a deadly drone strike which left 10 Afghans dead. This is America's longest war, but only one part of the war on terror, or as it should be called, the war of terror. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. As the last C-17 cargo plane took off from Kabul's international airport on August 30th, international headlines and news outlets worldwide all declared the departure of the last remaining U.S. troops, with the rest of their NATO allies like the United Kingdom also leaving in the days just prior. Broadcast on virtually every news network, this iconic image in infrared, shot in the dead of night, showing the last soldier, Major General Chris Donahue of the 82nd Airborne Division, climbing up the ramp of a C-17 cargo plane, the last American soldier to leave Afghanistan after a war that lasted two decades and claimed the lives of so many. It's said that around 50,000 Afghan civilians died in this war, but that is just a conservative estimate. The real figure is likely in the hundreds of thousands, with millions more being turned into refugees. Last year, Afghanistan's economy ministry reported that 90% of Afghans live below the poverty line. Following the departure of the last U.S. troops, people were in the streets celebrating, firing their guns in the air. Just take a listen to BBC's Lise Doucet, who reported from Kabul.
Well, I don't think we need to look at the news wires. You just have to listen to what's happening in the skies above us in Kabul. If that isn't confirmation, I don't know what is. Just listen to the crackle of gunfire.
Taliban fighters then quickly took over Kabul's international airport, the main site of U.S. evacuation efforts, and could be seen sweeping the hangars, inspecting the various aircraft and equipment left behind by the American troops. The crackle of gunfire continued well into the night in celebration of the Americans' departure. Aware that they were leaving, people had desperately clung to those very same U.S. planes taking off just a week ago. And as Biden had declared the counterterrorism mission in Afghanistan a success, a horrific explosion, the result of a terrorist attack, ripped through the crowds of people waiting to be evacuated outside the airport, killing 170 people and leaving 200 wounded. In response, Biden issued a strongly worded message and had this to say to the attackers.
To those who carried out this attack, as well as anyone who wishes America harm, know this. We will not forgive. We will not forget. We will hunt you down and make you pay.
Except that's not what happened. The next day, the U.S. launched a drone strike against alleged members of Daesh that it said were responsible for the attack, which of course is always convenient, right? As soon as there's a terrorist attack, all the intelligence services in Britain and America suddenly know exactly who is responsible and where these terrorists live and where to find them, but never before the attacks, which coincidentally helped them advance their agendas. Now, the Pentagon announced that in this drone strike it had killed two high-profile targets from Daesh and wounded another. The Pentagon also said there were no civilian casualties. That was a lie.
Yesterday, U.S. military forces conducted an over-the-horizon counterterrorism operation. Two high-profile ISIS targets were killed, and one was wounded. And we know of zero civilian casualties.
There were indeed many civilian casualties. When Biden launched that drone strike, something which he previously called an over-the-horizon capability, he murdered 10 civilians and then tried to cover it up, just like every war criminal president before him. Among the dead were seven children and three adults of the Ahmadi family, the youngest victim being 2 years old. This horrific murder of civilians, and basically an entire family, is not some isolated incident or an accident. It is emblematic of America's war on terror, or as it should be called, the war of terror. Some people may think that this is just an anomaly or an exception. They think that civilians being killed is just collateral damage, an acceptable price of war. However, it's neither an anomaly nor acceptable. What do you think the war on terror has been for the last 20 years? The whole time, innocent civilians have been killed by NATO forces and their deaths covered up. Half the time, the U.S. is not even sure who it is killing and then covers up the deaths. Just to give you an example, before Chelsea Manning leaked evidence of war crimes to WikiLeaks, there were 15,000 deaths in Iraq that were previously unknown but were kept secret by the U.S. military. Daniel Hale, a whistleblower who is now in prison, leaked information about the U.S. drone program and showed that under Obama, during a five-month period, 90%, yes, 90% of all the people killed by U.S. drones were not even the intended targets. They were civilians. This was covered up and kept hidden in order to avoid embarrassing the United States and exposing its criminal behavior. For the last two decades, ever since George Bush began the war on terror by invading Afghanistan, an imperialist project that has been continued by every president since, we have been told, the world has been told, that America and its allies are fighting global terrorism. They claim that they are making the world safer. But if you just look at the data, you can see that this is simply not true. Ever since the start of America's war on terror in 2001, the number of suicide attacks increased, with more suicide attacks worldwide than ever before. And after the invasion of Iraq in 2003, the number of global deaths from terrorism didn't decrease, it increased dramatically. The war on terror has made the world less safe and more violent. And such is the reality of America's war, not just in Afghanistan, but in Pakistan, Libya, Syria, Yemen, Iraq, and so on. And on the eve of the withdrawal, Biden gave a speech marking the end of the 20-year occupation of Afghanistan, America's longest war in history. Biden talked about the dead Marines that were killed in the attack at Kabul airport several times, but didn't even mention once the family that he murdered just a day before in a lethal drone strike. He didn't even mention the 170 Afghans who were also killed in the same blast. Why does American exceptionalism disregard the value and the lives of others? Biden started out by praising the withdrawal, praising himself, saying that 120,000 people had been successfully airlifted, among them 6,000 U.S. citizens. And Biden also said that he disagreed with critics who asked why the withdrawal couldn't have been done earlier or in a more orderly fashion. However, his response didn't address the fact that the U.S. abandoned Bagram Air Base last month, its largest air base in Afghanistan, in the middle of the night without even telling its allies or telling the Afghan security forces who were supposed to take over. And this begs the question, how can Biden call the withdrawal a success after creating such a security issue at Kabul's international airport? Why was the more capable, the more secure Bagram Air Base simply abandoned when it could have expedited things and perhaps helped to avoid such an atrocity? It simply doesn't make any sense. Biden then concluded his speech without taking any questions, but not before puffing his chest and making sure to issue menacing words towards Russia and China. He even dubbed them threats that the U.S. would have to contend with and reckon with at the same time as global terrorism. Now, CNN apparently did an interview with a Daesh commander just 2 weeks before this attack on Kabul airport. And of course, no opportunity was wasted by CNN's Clarissa Ward to make the issue about Sharia law and stoning people, trying, of course, to paint Muslims in a bad light, as Western media often does, instead of, you know, asking in-depth and pertinent, provocative questions about international relations, geopolitics, just given the seismic nature of this very war.
We were operating in Taliban's ranks, however, these people were not aligned with us in terms of belief, so we went to ISIS.
Do you think they're not strict enough with their implementation of Sharia?
You see, they can't present one example where they have enforced fixed Islamic law punishments, where they have cut off a thief's hand, have stoned to death an adulterer, have stoned to death a murderer.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
I have have the honor of being joined by Margaret Kimberly. She is the co-founder, editor, and senior columnist of the world-renowned Black Agenda Report, which has always been a cornerstone in the fight for black liberation and at the forefront of anti-war and anti-imperialist journalism. Thanks so much for coming on, Margaret. How are you?
Thank you for having me.
Margaret, I want to ask you first, what are your thoughts on this latest horrific U.S. drone strike, killing 10 Afghan civilians, basically wiping out an entire family?
Well, it tells you the story of Afghanistan. This is what the U.S. has been doing for the past 20 years. All this, it's very funny this in this country how Afghanistan was kind of disappeared. You didn't hear about it very often, but this is what the U.S. was doing, killing civilians. But all the while, when they did talk about it, propaganda about keeping women safe and the Taliban were going to be so evil. But meanwhile, the drone strikes destroying. I remember when Obama was president and the U.S. killed people in a hospital. Excuse me. And so this is what the U.S. has done. So they decide to leave. I'm glad they're leaving. It is a good thing. But of course, they can't even manage to do so in a way that's efficient and humane. So they make a mess of their departure, having apparently planned very little. Cause a bombing to take place as soon as Biden was taking criticism that magically there's a suicide bombing. And of course, they vow revenge but kill a family with little kids. So Afghanistan, which was a huge scam, $2 trillion spent going straight to the military-industrial complex, propping up puppet governments with the phony army, and we saw how phony it was towards the end. And so that's how, so America leaves the way it entered.
In his speech, you know, Biden referred to China and Russia as competition and new threats. What do you think of that? What does it mean when, as Biden is ending the war in Afghanistan, he's calling Russia and China new threats?
Well, my only concern about the U.S. withdrawing from Afghanistan is that they plan to concentrate their efforts somewhere else. And Russia and China, especially China now, adversary is the word they love to use. They're an adversary of the U.S. And that the U.S. has some right, just as it had the right to enter Afghanistan, has the right to confront China in its region of the world, because China has dared to be an economic rival of the U.S. So we hear constant propaganda, that is to say lies, about the Chinese government, about their people, about their infrastructure, everything, anything about China's, you know, China bad. You could just shorten it to that. So I am concerned about this withdrawal being part of a larger effort to confront other countries, and that is something we really have to keep an eye on.
You know, you see some people in the media who are visibly upset that the war is over. They'd like it to continue. I mean, what is your take on how the mainstream media is reporting on the issue and Biden's handling of it?
Well, everybody's performance has been abysmal. The corporate media in this country, they basically are mouthpieces for the state. They are mouthpieces for imperialism. And, you know, Americans even, it's a funny thing because I think if it were up to most people here, the U.S. would have left Afghanistan long ago. There was support for it in the wake of 9/11. That was the pretext for doing it. So there was very little opposition at the time. But there are many people, I'd say most people, who see no reason for the U.S. to be in Afghanistan after 20 years. So I think a withdrawal is something that in the abstract had popular support. But Americans like to think of their country as being good and efficient and doing things the right way. So I think there was, frankly, embarrassment. I think there was more concern about those first scenes we saw of people hanging on to airplanes. It was not the image that Americans have of themselves and have of their government. So it's easy for people who, in fact, may support the overall decision to be whipped up into a frenzy about America looking bad. These so-called journalists are just a disgrace. I thought he was going to cry, Richard Engel. You mentioned in particular, you know, this is not how America's supposed to be, and this is not how we are. And no mention, by the way, of the family that was wiped out in that last drone attack. Nothing. Apparently, that is how America is supposed to be. It's really been terrible. It's once again, we see, if you want to know what's happening in the world, the last thing you should do is consume the information given by corporate media in this country.
And, you know, I know a lot of people say that the war in Afghanistan is about resources, and of course it is in part, but could you explain perhaps how this war, and in fact imperialism in general, is also linked to racism?
Well, there are many, it seems that the global South is always a target for plunder, for control, for propping up presidents. The president of Afghanistan left town with $170 million. But apparently he left some of it behind. He, you know, was stuffing his airplane so full of stuff, and some of it got left behind. But they have these leaders, quote unquote, who are trained by the U.S., go to U.S. universities, et cetera, and then go back to their countries to help the U.S. And NATO do whatever they want. And it usually is the global South that is seen as being incapable of carrying on their own affairs and needing to be controlled. The white man's burden. Still here we are in the 21st century. That's essentially what it is. But I tell everyone, who should run Afghanistan except Afghans? And I want to point out something else. It's, you know, this interference is 40 years old. It started when Carter was president. So this has been going on for a very long time. And the Taliban, they were first the friends, the Mujahideen, and the U.S. was giving them money and weapons, and they met with Reagan, every president from Carter onward. This is a very long story, and liberals wringing their hands. Oh, my God. The Taliban will run Afghanistan. Well, they're Afghans. They, you know, let people in Afghanistan figure it out. And it's not our business who runs that country. But it's not our business who runs any country, frankly.
What do you make of these people who are trying to, you know, use women's rights as a pretext to continue occupying a sovereign country, to stay in Afghanistan and keep the war going?
It's the last refuge of scoundrels. I mean, I'm sorry. I don't see any other way to look at it. Nobody talks about the Afghan women who were killed in drone strikes. Nobody seems to care about that. Nobody seems to, there's amnesia about how, as I just said, these interventions have gotten rid of governments that would be friendlier to women and to their human rights. So that, to me, is very strange. But it just shows you how untrustworthy liberals are when you're talking about imperialism. This is a no time for this reformist nonsense. This is a time to really be serious and to look at the impact that the United States has around the world, and to question all of it, to question the 800 military bases around the world, to question the defense budget. It's 60% of the discretionary budget in the United States. And it's why we don't have the things that we need. So all of it, the right, this perceived right to intervene, the amount of money spent, the U.S. being all over the world, the biggest producer of fossil fuels in the world is the U.S. military. So people who claim to be concerned about climate change, they need to chime in here.
And when you have people in the media, or, you know, just pro-war people in general, imperialists, saying that the U.S. is abandoning its allies, what does that mean? What are they referring to exactly?
well, it's leaving its puppets behind, but that's what they do. We're talking about people who are scoundrels. So, no, they don't care if the translators or whomever else helped them during their occupation get left behind. They don't care. They're used, they're chewed up, and then spit out. But because Americans believe in exceptionalism and believe their country is so good, and so even in their criticism, it's a kind of criticism that it's more about imagery, frankly. So we can't leave our friends behind. Well, you know, this idea of using the first person when talking about the country, we and us, when we talk about our government, I don't say we or us. I say them or they. But Americans can very easily fall into that we left our allies behind. Well, they are collaborators in the eyes of people there, and that's what happens in wars. That's what happens. But during 20 years, I'm sure there are thousands of Afghans who decided to survive by working with the Americans in some capacity.
Lastly, Margaret, you know, after Vietnam, which was also humiliating, people thought there wouldn't be another war like that. But then the war on terror happened, which is arguably even worse. So, you know, some people are saying the same thing now when they're talking about the withdrawal from Afghanistan. Do you think the empire is, in fact, shrinking, as some say, or there's yet worse to come?
Well, there could be. I mean, considering these people who run our country, there could be something worse coming. You know, the system, the current defense secretary, Mr. Austin, came straight from Raytheon to the Pentagon. I mean, they're not even trying to hide it anymore. There's supposed to be some period of time. You can't go from a defense contractor to a position in the Defense Department. You're supposed to wait a couple of years. And they had this waiver. He went straight from Raytheon to the Pentagon. And that tells you all you need to know about how this all works.
As far as withdrawals go, what we've seen so far only deals with America's uniformed troops. However, if we look back at 2001, the first Americans on the ground in Afghanistan were CIA paramilitaries.